Hey, what's going on? Arden Zwelling here for At The Letters, brought to you by the all-new 2019 Ford Ranger, featuring best-in-class gas payload and towing. Haul more, tow more on your next adventure in the all-new Ford Ranger. Ben Nixon-Smith is with me, as always, and this week we sat down with Pete Walker, the Toronto Blue Jays pitching coach, before a recent game at Rogers Centre to talk a bit about, obviously, the Toronto Blue Jays pitching staff and some guys in particular, his impressions of TJ Zoik and Anthony Kay. We got into a little bit of his career. Might not remember that he had a few years in the majors back in the day with the Toronto Blue Jays. So we talked a bit about the differences that he notices between the game now and when he pitched, and some of the guys that he liked throwing to. And we kind of looked forward to some of the new tech in the game, some of the new tools and devices that the Blue Jays are using in order to measure pitchers and help them get better. And finally, we talked about the Blue Jays' use of the opener.
We don't have it perfected. I think we've done a pretty good job with it. I mean, I'm happy with the results we've gotten. I'm sure Charlie is in the front office as well. But I think it's still a work in progress to figure out exactly how to do it. And then the other thing is to really weigh if we're going to approach it differently in the minor leagues, double and triple A, and get some guys used to doing it. So, you know, maybe three or four times a year, those starters actually come in after a reliever.
Here's our interview with Toronto Blue Jays pitching coach Pete Walker. Pete, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it. Taking time out of your busy schedule. It's like 2 o'clock before a game right now. If you weren't recording a podcast, what are you typically doing at this point in your day?
That's interesting. Well, thank you for having me here. Number one, I just got done with a meeting, to be honest with you, about an hour and a half, talking about our pitchers with our front office, going through some things, obviously, for next year as well, and off-season plans. But typically around this time, I'm finishing up my own workout. Usually get in here with Matt Bushman and a few of the other coaches. We like to keep ourselves in shape and take care of ourselves. So usually finishing up a workout and then digging into last night's game about right now.
When you look at a game, so you know, last night, we're recording this on Thursday, Trent Thornton really good against the Red Sox. That's probably more of a fun video to look back at. But when you're looking back, what are you looking for? Like, what's that process like for you?
To be honest with you, actually, after each inning, during the game itself, I pop into the video room. So I actually see it as the game's going on to kind of check on some things. But then the next day, I'll watch the entire game back and, you know, and get some feedback from the pitcher that night. But really just looking for their command, their execution, pitch selection at certain times, obviously, you know, dictated by the catcher who's suggesting a certain pitch. And obviously, ultimately, it's the pitcher's responsibility to, you know, make the pitch. But, you know, I just basically go through each inning, each hitter, how we attacked them, how we executed, and, you know, basically grade the pitcher. And, you know, then we have some discussion points during the course of the day.
Interesting. So even within the game, like the Jays are hitting, Vladdy and Bo are up there, and then you're obviously going to be aware of what the hitters are doing, but you're watching that pitcher again.
Correct. Sometimes you won't see me on the bench when we're hitting because I'm in the video room just going through that exact inning, the previous inning that the pitcher threw, and kind of breaking it down. And again, looking for execution, seeing how he's performing, seeing how the ball's moving, because you can only see so much from the dugout. You get an idea of what the ball's doing, but you know, to be able to see it on video, you can see the true action of the slider or the sinker, how they're locating their four-seam fastball, if they're executing at the top of the zone. Those are the kind of things I look for. And then it gives me more feedback to that pitcher, you know, when I get back to the dugout and actually can tell him, hey, you know, this is what I'm seeing, you know, exclusively on the video, and this is what we got to get back to doing.
Do you have to be selective about what you come back to a pitcher with? Because I'm sure, you know, you watch an inning and you could probably find 20 things, and do you have to kind of pick two or three?
Exactly. I mean, you keep it simple. Usually pick out the most important thing. I don't overwhelm them by any stretch, but there can be multiple things that you could discuss, but you really got to pick out one, maybe two, just to give them a little something to go back out there with. Because there are times when they're going good, I won't say a word. If they're executing their pitches, they're making, you know, they're rolling along, I'll leave them alone. But when they're struggling a little bit, obviously, they need something. They need something to kind of, okay, that makes sense, I'll go out there and do it. And then they can kind of focus on that, and it can get them back on track.
Ben mentioned Trent Thornton, who goes out there with a couple of Clay Buchholz grips and has all kinds of success. Does that say one thing about, you know, the impact that Clay's having on young pitchers as a veteran? But does it also say another thing about Trent Thornton kind of figuring it out as a young guy right now?
He's impressive. I mean, for a lot of reasons. It can work against him at times because he's constantly searching, which is a great thing. It's kind of like Marcus Stroman. You know, he can kind of try something and kind of figure it out really quickly. Trent has that ability too, to spin a baseball and to feel a baseball. He's had some ups and downs this year, certainly. He can spin a curveball with the best of them. And having a guy like Clayton around, I mean, in baseball, even when I was playing, you constantly talk to fellow pitchers and you talk about grips and things that work for them. If somebody does something well, you're always picking their brain. I mean, that's part of the game. So, you know, Clay has been great with the younger guys. You know, we haven't had a ton of veteran experience here, so obviously having him here has been impactful. You know, he's been around, he's pitched in some huge games, been a part of some great teams, so he has that instant respect. And the two of them have kind of gravitated towards each other. It's kind of nice. But, you know, their lockers are next to each other. Trent's asking him a million questions a day, probably driving him nuts, but, you know, Clay's taking care of him. But, you know, I think that the grip itself, you know, Trent could spin a baseball, but the biggest thing with him right now is we're trying to get his slot more consistent with his fastball slot. And the grip that Clay had showed him with his third finger actually a little bit more underneath the ball seems to have gotten him there. So, you know, it's awesome. And it definitely helped last night. You know, and again, as pitchers go through a season, we're constantly tinkering to a fault sometimes.
Right.
And trying to find new grips, trying to find something else that works. And sometimes something clicks, and it's actually great when it does.
So when you look back to even a few years ago, 2016, suddenly it seems like a long time ago in a way, because that season you guys had five starters that made at least, I think it was 28 or 29 starts, and you only used seven all season long. And then fast forward only 3 years, like it's not that long. And now you guys have used 38 pitchers, including Richard Urania and Luke Maley. So, yeah. You know, 36 actual pitchers. Yeah. And 20 of them have started. Like, for you, what's that transition been like? Because that's a huge shift in the composition of the staff.
That's a huge shift. Obviously, when you go through a starting season like that, we had in 16, you know, and you have minimal starting pitchers. This consistency, you know, between the starting pitchers and the catchers, when you're attacking certain teams, they've had such familiarity with how we've done it, it just makes things so much easier. But when you have 20 starters, obviously the catchers are catching a lot of different arms. The pitchers are trying to get used to the catchers. You know, we're trying to, you know, put together game plans. It certainly isn't easy. It's a challenge. It's not something that's I don't think about it that much. You just kind of take it game by game, week by week. So, you know, the fact that we've had 20 starters is something that's kind of come into my attention lately. You know, I kind of knew we were in a situation like that, but I wasn't counting them. But I think, you know, it's just the hand that you're dealt, so to speak. I mean, you deal with it. The way I've looked at it is, you know, every new pitcher that comes in here, you know, I give them the spiel that, hey, it's an opportunity for you to, this is the opportunity you've been waiting for, to be honest with you. Some guys have been on the outside looking in. They've been in AAA. They've struggled in the big leagues or been DFA'd. And they're coming here, and it really is an opportunity for them to step up. So, you know, it's one of those years that's been frustrating from that standpoint. But we've had guys that have taken the ball, and some guys have run with it. Some guys haven't. But it's been one of those years where it's not ideal. But believe it or not, with some of the losses, and there's been some positive signs that we're encouraged about.
When you get a guy like an Anthony Kay or a Ryan Fairbend, like somebody that you're not familiar with and that you haven't worked with in spring training's past, do you have a process that you go through in terms of familiarizing yourself with their stuff and them?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Obviously, you get some player development reports. You watch some video. You know, like Anthony Kay, he's a UConn guy, and I'm a UConn guy, so that's right. You know, that's a good
that
thing
helps.
For him.
Yeah.
But you do a little research on him. You find out where they've been, what they've done. Obviously, you get information from the front office and the analytics department about what they could do to be more successful. And, you know, then it's just really watching them throw. Then you kind of put it all together. And I was real impressed with him. You know, it was really when he first got here, it was pretty much, hey, you know, I know you've worked hard to get here. We're not going to change anything right now. And maybe we don't have to change anything at all. But for right now, go out and pitch your game. You know, we gave him a game plan. We talked about how to attack the hitters and utilizing his stuff. And let him go do his thing, and he did a great job. So again, you don't try to overwhelm him too much right away. Keep it simple, get them comfortable as they can, as quickly as they can, and I think they perform the best that way. You know, and if there's a struggle that ensues or they have some issues, then you look to make some adjustments.
With Kay in particular, I mean, to see him throw 94, 95, top of the zone, and then mix in that breaking ball, and even the changeup seemed like he was throwing it for strikes at least. What were your impressions from him against a pretty good team?
Yeah, I was really impressed, to be honest with you. Again, your expectations, you got to keep them reasonable for someone's major league debut. So you try not to put too much stock into the results, to be honest with you. The first few times are difficult. The nerves, the jitters of being finally these guys reaching their dream, and they put so much pressure on themselves. They probably got their family watching, everybody back home. So there's so many intangibles and variables that go into it. And I think with him, though, watching him work, he was very even-keeled. He handled the situation tremendously well. I thought his stuff was outstanding. His four-seam fastball command, he pounded the right-handers in exclusively and really dominated them in there. They couldn't handle his fastball inside, which was great. For me, that's great to see. And I thought his secondary stuff was better than I expected. His curveball was effective. His changeup he kept on the outer third, especially to right-handers. And he even used some left-on-left changeup. So he did a lot of things that I loved. And he pounded the zone. And he really, for a major league debut, it was exceptional.
20 starters and 36 pitchers. It's a lot of work for you. I think it's a lot of work for your catchers in particular. Yep. When you think of guys like Dane Jansen, Reese McGuire, young in their careers, and now they're getting thrown, they're catching a different guy every day and having to learn all these repertoires. What have you thought of the job those guys have done?
That's a great point. It's not easy. It's not easy for a veteran guy, so never mind inexperienced catchers coming in, Jano and Reese, even Luke when he was healthy. It's not easy. And trying to figure out what these guys do best, and obviously we give them input. The good thing is about some Reese and Jano, they've caught a few of these guys, so that does help. There's some experience in the minor league level, but certainly at this level, when you're trying to get familiar with everybody so fast, it's hard. That's typically what spring training's for. You get a chance to see everybody in spring training, and then you go with your guys for a while. But up here this year, it's been such turnover. It's difficult for them. And then they're trying to hit as well. It's a fine balance. Being a young catcher, when you're struggling offensively at times, and then you're trying to put a game plan together and make sure you're locked into every pitch, it's a lot on their plate. So I think they've done an awesome job. Kind of a two-headed monster right now, the two of them. Jano's going to hit better, for sure. He's shown certainly signs over the last month or so of coming out of it and putting the bat on the ball and hitting it hard. Reese has been exceptional hitting, probably the best he's ever hit in his career. I don't know. I mean, it's been really, he's done a great job. But they both feed off each other. They take criticism well. It's very constructive, but they take it well, and they look to get better. So the two of them have been very good for this team, and moving forward, I feel like we're in good hands.
How much of a difference do you think that can make? Because, I mean, before those guys, you guys had Russ Martin, who was obviously regarded as a good receiver and defensive catcher. If you're looking at, the, whatever it is, 1,500 innings or I don't know the exact number, but you guys have so many innings in the course of a season. What kind of an impact can it be to have a strong defensive catcher back there?
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. I think the biggest thing I look at, and even thinking back to when I pitched, was you want a guy that you want to throw to, number one. And the pitchers that I've had up here, nobody complains about the catchers. And believe it or not, that does happen at times.
For example, that's me saying that, not you, but you look at the Wilson Ramos stuff that's happening
correct.
Right now. And yeah.
And that's it's really not that unusual. It does happen, just never usually gets out publicly. there are always comments to the pitching coach, the manager, for certain starting pitchers, who they like behind the plate. So that's not unusual, but it's great when you get to the point where they like both guys and there's no issues with either of them. And it just makes the job of, matching up who's going to catch a certain day based on the opposing pitcher more than who's your guy that's on the mound. I think that's really important. So we're fortunate in that area. We got two strong-minded catchers that can receive well, that can frame well, that can throw well. They both are learning how to call a good game.
Who were those guys for you when you pitched? You were saying you think back to those days. Who were those guys for you?
I mean, as far as like me personally or
yeah,
just...
for you personally. That you liked throwing to?
That I like throwing to. Oh, that's actually a good question. Darren Fletcher, in the short time I had him here. Ken Huckabee, I matched up with a lot in Toronto. I enjoyed throwing to him. Brooke Fordyce, back in my Mets days, I thought he called a great game. We're from the same area, so that helped.
Right.
But it made a big difference. The catches that you have behind home plate, the comfort level you have with them, the minimum of times you have to shake. We just feel like you're always on the same page. As a pitcher, when you have to shake a lot, you're second-guessing your pitches, that usually comes back to haunt you. And that's where the separation comes between the pitcher and the catcher. You want to be able to be on the same page. And once you get to that point, there's usually a little you're in sync, and the results are usually better.
Thinking as a pitching coach now, what would you have told that late 90s, early 2000s Pete Walker? Like, what would you have told him to get more out of his career?
That's another good question. I kind of evolved as a pitcher. I was fortunate enough to play for almost 18 years, so yeah. I came in as a power pitcher in my early days with the Mets as a like a prospect closer type. You know, through in the mid 90s with a four seam fastball, big slider, and after my first shoulder surgery, it was more sinker, small cutter, split. I kind of changed because my velocity wasn't there. But, you know, I had some pretty good pitching coaches along the way that helped me a lot. And to be honest with you, I'm very fortunate to get, you know, 5 years pitching in the major leagues after the age of 31, because that doesn't happen a lot.
No.
Especially a guy that has been through a couple of different surgeries. So I was very fortunate. But looking back, I think, you know, in today's game with the elevation, I was always down in the zone, you know, sinker, slider, split, everything was knees and below. And if I was up around the thighs, I was unhappy about it. But looking back, I'd probably tell myself, for sure, take more shots up in the zone, because it was open back then too. And the strike zone was a little bigger. So I think I could have used my four-seam fastball a little bit more. And I probably would have made myself pitch inside more. I think I was more of a, you know, trying to miss bats and avoid contact, you know, and kind of flirt around the outside part of the zone a lot. You know, because I didn't have dominant stuff, so.
It's really interesting, and it kind of raises the whole idea of how much pitching has changed and probably how much the role of pitching coaches has changed. When you think back to some of those coaches that you had and compare that to now, like, yeah. That's got to be a totally different role, right?
It is, and I think back to the coaches I had some really good ones. Right. Don't get me wrong. They were really good, but it was a different approach. It was a simpler approach. It was minimal mechanics. There certainly weren't evidence of analytics and looking at where you're effective in the zone and your pitch percentages and batting average against in certain areas on certain pitches. I don't think I ever had any of that. So the information that we get now is, it can be overwhelming, and a lot of it, a lot of it is sifted through, because certainly you can't provide all that to the players today. They can be overwhelmed. But for me, I get a lot of good information from the front office, sift through it, and focus on, you know, trying to be specific in some areas that we can make these guys better. But again, back in the day, it was strictly, hey, keep the ball down. If you're up in the zone, you get yelled at. You know, if you're pitching around the thighs, you know, it'd be get the ball down in the zone, you're not going to have a job. And so it has changed a lot. But I think it was a simpler time. They went with the gut a lot more, for sure. And I think nowadays you're seeing a lot more, you know, it's more of an exact science that's trying to be, you know.
Well, it feels like nowadays everybody's trying to go four seamers up. And you mentioned that, like, TJ Zoik the other night, it looked like he was trying to get there and didn't quite execute. But you said back in your day, it was still open then. And to me, it's the swing plane thing is kind of what guys are trying to counter right now. But there wasn't as much of a focus on launch angle back then.
Correct.
So what's going on? Why has it been open this long?
You know, it's interesting. I do think there was a little different approach back then. Obviously, they weren't thinking of home runs, and they were more concerned with not striking out. That was just, you know, put the ball in play. So they were able to get to the ball up a little bit more, just trying to make contact, but it was still open. Maybe not to the point it is now, you know, but I think, you know, with launch angles and with guys really focusing on that and getting that ball in the air primarily, there is a difference. The game was different, there's no doubt. More hit and run, more hit the ball the other way, move a runner over, bunts. I mean, it was definitely different. But I still think players were just as vulnerable back then. You just had to be a little bit better at it.
When you think about the various resources that you guys have, and, you know, that's everything from video that's accessible to you in the middle of a game, to analytic reports, to, you know, player development people that you can have access to at any given moment, how do you prioritize that? Like, I mean, even Arden and I, sometimes we're looking through various websites and reading articles, and, like, there's an overwhelming amount of information, and you guys have even more, like, way more access than we do. So how do you handle all that?
It's interesting you say that. I mean, I really try not to overwhelm myself. I have specific things I look for. I do spend time looking at video. We have Edutronics, and we can look at grips, and especially in our bullpen sessions, we're using Rapsodo now to talk about spin axis and get different, the vertical and horizontal breaks on pitches. We're looking at those a little closer. Again, I still think there's a fine line between too much and too little. I think it's a blend. I think you need to see what works to kind of develop your own thought process and system, which I think we're doing here. So we're picking and choosing what we think is the best out there. But there is, it's overwhelming, the amount of information. You can go on any website and find something, but I think you can get consumed with it too, where it can actually work against you. And I've seen that happen with some players. You know, they're more concerned with what their ball actually is doing than getting the hitter out. But, you know, they can talk about, well, it had the right break and it had, but you know what? We just gave up a double in the gap, you know? So there's a fine line, you know, it's bottom line business. It's about wins up here. It's about getting outs. It's about being effective. And so I still think we got to get that message across.
When you started as a pitching coach here, what did the words Rap Soto and Edutronic mean to you? Anything?
Yeah, nothing, to be honest with you. Absolutely nothing. And definitely before, you know, came after that time. I've been involved in a baseball convention, to be honest with you. The World Baseball Coaches Convention at the Mohegan Sun in Connecticut for the past 16 years. We started up back in 2003. And so I've seen a lot of different gadgets and ideas come through. You know, we have over 100 vendors every year, so I see a ton of different things, and it's amazing what has come and gone. You know, some ideas that were great back then are gone now, and, right. and other ideas have kind of popped up. But there are certain things, again, there are fads out there and things that people buy into, and then they realize 2 or 3 years later that might not have been as good as they thought. So I think that's something we got away, because there are so many ideas out there and so many people are trying to make a buck too. But I certainly think there's a lot of value in a lot of things we're using right now.
The interesting thing to me about those tools is that it gives you that, the word objective gets thrown around a lot in this organization, but you can actually see, instead of just the catcher saying, oh, that one came out good, you know, you can actually see how it came off your fingers. You can actually put a number behind, oh, that did actually break well. And then you could take that and try to recreate that going forwards. Is that kind of how you want to see pitchers utilizing those tools?
Definitely. And I think that's how we're doing it right now. You know, and we'll even send, like, sometimes on the Edutronic or, you know, we'll have a good grip and a good spin we're looking for, and we'll email it to the pitcher so they can have it as a memory, right. you know, to kind of see what their hand was doing. And that's one thing about coaching in the past. You know, it was more or less standing behind the pitcher on the mound and telling him, well, I think you got to get your fingers over the ball a little bit. It happens so quick. It's almost impossible to see. It is impossible to see. You're basically going on the break of the pitch and what the pitch is doing and kind of telling him where he should be with his hand, where now you can see it, an incredible rate of speed. You know what I mean? So it's amazing how they can slow it down. So there's a lot of benefits to the new technology. We're trying to utilize it the best we can, and I'm sure we'll get better at it.
So a pitcher on a given morning, like, for example, Trent Thornton today might wake up and see a really high def image of a pitch that he released and have that for reference?
It's more or less bullpens, to be honest with you. Yeah, you know, when we work down there, but there are certainly opportunities for us to do that, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like you want the inverse. Like, you want a pitcher to say, that one came out well, and then the Rapsodo information just confirms what he felt, instead of saying, well, let's go the other way. You want him to say, no, that was a good curveball, and you're looking at the iPad and you're like, yeah, it was.
Correct. That's exactly what it should be, confirmation. I agree with that 100%. That's exactly how we use it.
So on any given night, there's probably 15 baseball games, assuming it's not, you know, Monday or Thursday, and you're watching one of them super, super closely. As for the other 14, I mean, you're obviously a baseball fan, longtime player, a longtime coach. Are you totally, like, done with pitching after you've watched a game up close and spent your entire day with it? Or do you go home and, like, watch highlights of Justin Verlander and Garrett Cole and Ryan Yarbrough and whoever else is pitching on a given night?
I definitely don't go. I don't watch those guys. Yeah. I'm done for the day.
Yeah.
No, that's not true. I'm kidding. I love the game. I've been in it forever, for a long time for me. But I do find myself, it's funny, after a game, we'll have the TVs on, the game's on in the coach's room, and then there'll be somebody pitching in some situation, and we'll end up watching it as coaches, you know, just trying to see what happens, see the whether it's a pitcher in a tough situation, the seventh, eighth, or ninth inning, a crucial point of the game. So, yeah, I find myself, if it's on, I'm watching it. But there are certainly times I want to get away. I mean, because it is a long day. It's been a grind, you know, Major League season, 162 games with 30 spring training games, so it's a long year. You know, I think some people still think we show up, you know, an hour before the game, and, you know, it's a great life. But it is a long day, especially as coaches. As players, it was, you know, it's a grind, but you're focused on yourself a lot. As a coach, you're focused on your entire team. And for me, it's a 12-man or 13-man or 20-man pitching staff right now. So you're focused on that. Honestly, I live and die with every pitch. I love it. You know, and so it's not just me pitching and worrying about myself. Every inning of every game, every pitch that's thrown, I feel like I'm throwing it. So it's stressful.
Yeah. I mean, it is pretty crazy when you think about, like, from day one of spring training, or probably before, so that's like mid-February at that point, and then you have, you know, bullpen sessions and live BPs, and then you work your way into, you know, intra-squad games and then games, and you're watching all this, and then the actual season starts and you have 180 days straight where, like, even the off days there's some banquet or it's a travel day. Like, it is, like, pretty insane once you get to this point.
It is. It's a long year, and, you know, again, you're traveling a lot as well, so it's not as glamorous as everybody thinks, but it's certainly a great life. I wouldn't trade it for the world, but it's definitely can be long, especially when you have a season that doesn't go exactly the way you want it to, or you're not, you know, you don't make it to the postseason. So it's just a little more difficult to get through, but again, you find silver linings, you find guys that step up, and you find a way to enjoy it. And to be honest with you, I've had a lot of enjoyment out of this year, and it seems crazy. Obviously we want to win and get back to where we need to be, but there's been a lot of good things that happened too.
You mentioned the stress of it during a game and hanging on to every pitch. And there was a great shot of you on the broadcast the other night when Ken Giles was trying to navigate his way through a save. You were out of your seat. Right. You're sitting back down. You're rubbing your forehead. I mean, you could see it, right? You could see how invested you were in every pitch. Has his season and trying to get the most out of him as he's gone through some health troubles over the back half of this year, has that been one of the bigger challenges for you this year?
Yeah, I mean, he's been awesome. He's been so good for us. Obviously, we had a little issue there for a little while. We're fortunate to still have him in my estimation, yeah. In my mind. You know, he's been such a valuable part in being able to close out games. He's one of the best relievers in the game, but certainly you get to that ninth inning and, you know, I guess, you know, me and Charlie joke, and we know that camera's on us sometimes, and I try to recognize when it's on me and when it isn't, so I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
I try to be stone-faced, but the emotion of the game, and when it gets to the end, you know you need a win. A team needs a win, and it's a crucial part of the game. You know, I'm definitely more emotional than people think. Again, as a coach, you want to try to keep it somewhat subdued, but I still feel like a player sometimes in those situations, and I get fired up.
So you've mentioned a few times that there are silver linings for this team and this pitching staff in a season like this. Not that we're done the year, there's still another 15 games or whatever it is, but what are some of the silver linings that you look at on this pitching staff, guys that have stepped up in your view?
You know what? It's interesting you say that. I think I still, one guy that goes unrecognized and has had a tremendous year in my mind is Sam Gaviglio. You know, kind of one of those guys that's goes under the radar, kind of undervalued in the game, but kind of the glue for your staff, and eats so many innings and pitches so many valuable innings that protect a lot of other guys. And I think his, you know, strikeout to walk ratio there is phenomenal. I mean, he's striking out almost one an inning, and I think he probably has 15 walks in the year. So he's done a lot of good things. His ERA, I think, is over 4, but it shouldn't be. It was a couple of weeks where he had a little bit of a struggle, but he's been tremendous. We've kept him exclusively out of the pen this year. But, you know, Trent Thornton's had some ups and downs, but certainly shown signs, like last night, of what he could potentially do when we get him more consistent. Jacob Waggisbeck stepped up and done some nice things for us. You know, getting Anthony Kay up here now and getting a look at him is nice. Then you look at the bullpen. Obviously, we lost some pretty good arms that were doing a great job for us, and Hudson and Phelps, and hopefully we got good returns for those guys. The bullpen's done a great job. You know, Derek Law, who, again, had some issues early on here and there, but has turned into be a high leverage guy for us. Kenny Giles has been tremendous. So, you know, you look at where we're at, and it's disappointing record-wise for sure, but there's certainly been some good things with the staff. And I know even since the All-Star break, we've been throwing the ball pretty well and somehow keeping us in ball games every night. So, you know, talking to John Lott a little bit yesterday about the walks, and that's been the biggest thorn on our side. And, you know, we do have to find a way to minimize those, and I think we'd be obviously in a lot better shape.
You mentioned Gaviglio with the ERA over 4, but he's been really good. I feel like a 4 ERA in today's game isn't as bad as it used to be.
Yeah.
But of course, every pitcher still wants a low ERA. You kind of have to talk to guys and say, well, no, actually, like, look at your Ks to walks.
Or,
you know, look at this other stat. Don't be so focused on the ERA.
I know, and that's an old school approach and a thought, but it's still there for the pitchers. It's funny, you know, because they want that low ERA, but obviously, FIP, and you got weak contact, hard contact, you know, strikeout to walk ratio. There's so many different things you can look at that show that you're having a strong season. But, you know, it's just kind of the old school thought process for a pitcher. They want a low ERA.
Yeah.
They do, you know, because that's what goes on their baseball card for the most part.
But you look at this era where more runs scored than ever, like a home run record was just set. ERA is going to be up across the league. Do you see it changing maybe with younger guys coming up through the game who are more interested in, well, I don't really care that much about my ERA. What about my hard hit rate? Or, you know, what about this?
Oh, I think it'll happen. I don't know if it's necessarily happened yet, but I think that's the direction we're going. I think that's, you know, obviously with the amount of home runs that are being hit, record pace, even in AAA. I mean, guys are getting, you know, where it used to have solid numbers in AAA, guys are struggling a little bit down there and giving up a lot of home runs. But I do think over time, I think pitchers are adjusting to what's really important and understanding that there's certain things that they can control and other things that they can't control. And I think the weak contact, hard contact is going to be big. To talk about the exit velocities and all those, you know, that's what hitters, you hear hitters talking about it more and more, where even early in the year, nobody really paid much attention to it. Now they're talking about, hey, that was 112 miles an hour off the bat, or things that kind of, in a way, they bug me because, you know, it's still an out or whatever. But it's interesting, is I think even the official scorers get caught up in it because, you know, a lot of the, from a pitching standpoint, I think there should be more errors in the game. And it seems like they look at that exit velocity and the ball off the bat, and it dictates whether it's a hit or an error a lot. And I still think if it's hit 150 miles an hour, it goes through your legs, it's an error.
Right.
It's interesting. Figured I'd bring that up. Not to get on the official scores, but I've seen some crazy calls this year.
Yeah, and I think also like the fact that it's posted on the scoreboard, everyone sees it. Right, so it's just there. You can just look. Oh, yeah, it was 112. So everyone in the stadium knows. Yeah. Whereas that would have been like the most, even 5 years ago, no one had any idea that that was how hard it was hit.
Correct. It was either hit hard or it wasn't.
Right. That's it.
Now it's 102, 108, 94, 115. It is what it is. I got to accept it.
Is it getting harder and harder to live as a pitcher who relies on contact then? Like, take a guy like TJ Zoik, right? Yep. Doesn't strike out a ton of guys, and throwing that sinker down in the zone, he wants the ball in play. But like you said, with the emphasis on, you know, higher bat speeds, higher exit velocities, is it getting harder to survive as that kind of guy?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's kind of how it's looked upon. I don't know if it's 100% accurate yet. I mean, obviously, it's nice to get a ground ball every once in a while, for sure. And if you can get the ball on the ground, I think if you're shifting correctly and you're putting your guys in the best position to get outs, I still think it's a good thing. But I think with those guys, we're actually emphasizing more, especially in the minor leagues, the sinker ballers of the world, definitely learning how to elevate, at least be able to do it. I'm not saying it has to be a strength, but to at least change their eye level so they can be more effective and get away with a little bit more down the zone. So when they leave it thigh high, it's not a home run. So it's definitely something we're concentrating on and trying to rectify.
Well, especially when every ball that's in the air now seems to have a pretty good chance of going over the fence. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've seen, like, excuse me swings and the ball goes out to the opposite field.
Extremely frustrating. We've seen it all year. And, you know, I don't think I'll ever accept it because I've seen it. I really have. I've seen it an awful lot this year, more than any other year. You know, it used to be the approach in the past was, especially late in the game, don't get beat in. And it's really, you might as well throw that out now because you can get beat. You can make a great pitch just off the plate away to a hitter in a close game late in the game, and the guy, the 7, 8, 9 hitter takes you opposite field, slices one down the line for a home run. So we've seen it. So it does change your approach a little bit. You're not safe throwing that ball away off the plate to the number 9 hitter. So that's where I think the game has changed, not really in the right direction. So we'll take more shots in late because it really is a different approach, and there's just as much opportunity to get a guy out inside than there is away.
Does that change mentality too as a pitcher in terms of how you react to those results? Like, when something like that happens to you, you can't, obviously you don't want to lose the game, but if you made a good pitch, you made a good pitch.
Yeah. No, it's true. And I think guys have come to that realization. It's still frustrating.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know, we've had many conversations about that as pitchers and, you know, from a pitching coach to my pitchers about that subject. And it's just really, hey, this is where the game is right now. We got to continue to get better. Don't accept that it happened. We'll make a better pitch next time. But you certainly don't get away with as much.
Last one I wanted to ask you about was openers, which you guys have used a lot recently. I'm curious about the criteria for when you will use an opener and when you will not, because we've seen Zoik pitch behind an opener and then not. We saw Anthony Kay when he made his debut. He didn't pitch behind an opener, but Zoik did. So how do you kind of come to that determination?
I think we're working through that, to be honest with you. I don't think we have it perfected yet, but I do think we're having good discussions about it and trying to figure out the best way to compete that night, to put the pitcher, the starting pitcher, in the best position possible to get outs and have success. And then obviously you got to match that up with the potential of having a solid opener, someone who can do it, someone who matches up well against the opposing team. So I think there's quite a few variables that go into that decision. It's not easy. Obviously you have minor league pitchers that come up through the system starting all the time. So when they get to the major leagues, you want them to be comfortable. You don't want to throw them out of their routine. So that's obviously debated as well. But I think the biggest thing is you're looking at where we are at this stage of the season. We want to win ball games. We also want to develop. but we do want to put these guys in the best position to succeed. So again, I think we opened for Zoik one time, then we let him start the next time. Obviously he's earned the right to start a major league game and see what he can do, but sometimes, you know, there's different approaches, and sometimes the old school approach was break some of these guys in the bullpen anyway, you know, some of these starters, let them get comfortable. But I'm kind of going around in circles a little bit. I think the biggest thing right now is, you know, Wilmer Font's done a great job as an opener. He's certainly a guy that can do it and consistently do it and give you an inning or two innings with good results. Then you have your second guy coming in at the bottom part of the order, doesn't have to face the top part three times. It does make sense. Is it ideal? No. I want five guys that can go nine innings.
Of course.
I mean, I think everybody ideally wants that, and our front office wants that. So, but in the meantime, we got guys that are, you know, Trent has had some struggles at different times this year. He's getting to the point in the season where it's been a long year. You know, he pitched in a six-man rotation at AAA, and now he's in the big leagues pitching every 5 days. So we're trying to protect him as well and finish and get him to the finish line feeling good. So that was the decision last night, and it worked. So obviously, you know, if it didn't work, we'd have, you know, there'd be questions today about why we did it, but it was one of those things that worked out well.
Well, these are also guys who aren't used to pitching into September necessarily, right? Yeah. Their minor league seasons have been ending at the end of August.
Exactly. So there is a difference, and it's the length of the season too. It's not just the innings. It's out there every day throwing, playing catch, going through your routine. So again, we don't have it perfected. I think we've done a pretty good job with it. I mean, I'm happy with the results we've gotten. I'm sure Charlie is in the front office as well. But I think it's still a work in progress to figure out exactly how to do it. And then the other thing is to really weigh if we're going to approach it differently in the minor leagues, double and triple A, and get some guys used to doing it. So, you know, maybe three or four times a year, those starters actually come in after a reliever. So it's not something that's highly unusual to them.
Really interesting stuff. Thanks, Pete.
Hey, anytime. I had a blast.
Thanks to Pete for joining us. Always good to catch up with Pete Walker, who's been the Toronto Blue Jays coach for a rather long time now, spanning regimes, spanning coaching staffs. I think it speaks to the job that he does with pitchers and how they respond to him and his willingness to adapt and embrace new tools and techniques and just his work ethic that he has stuck around as long as he has, as other coaches have kind of bled away.
Yeah, you could tell that Pete, when he was talking about it with us, didn't want to, you know, dwell on the fact that he's working these long days, because it is part of the job and he obviously gets that. But imagine watching every single pitch of the Toronto Blue Jays season, not just once, but twice. You know, he's watching it again between innings, and then afterwards he's watching it again. Like, he has seen so much, like living and dying with every pitch. So no question, it takes a lot of focus and it takes a lot of commitment to really be that dialed in. And it takes a lot of, you know, watching rockets go off the bats of opposing hitters, because this has been a tough year for a lot of the pitchers that the Blue Jays have brought in.
When he started as the Blue Jays staff, John Farrell was the manager. That's how long it's been for Pete Walker. So that's how many pitches, right? That's every year.
Thousands.
How many pitches,
right? Thousands and thousands.
Spring trainings, couple playoff runs in there. He's earning his paycheck. And it's interesting just to hear about some of the Rapsodo stuff that the Blue Jays are using now and the Edgertronic cameras and being able to, you know, because I think that what that's addressing in the game is, you know, a guy would throw a side or a bullpen and say the catcher is like his buddy. Of course, catcher's going to be like, oh yeah, that one broke, right? Like, oh, that was a good curveball. And the pitching coach is standing behind him and watching this, like, you know, 90 mile an hour pitch and saying, oh yeah, that had good cut on it. Or what? You can't really tell with the naked eye. The Rapsodo and the Edgertronic just lets you slow it down. It gives you like objective data that says whether or not a pitch actually broke well. And it lets you actually figure out what you are doing in order to get that action on the pitch in terms of your fingers or how you're, you know, gripping the ball or how it's coming out of your hand, and try to repeat that and recreate that going forward.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure that, you know, if it's something simple, like you got a veteran pitcher, you can tell with the naked eye or not. Not necessarily you or I, but no. Pete Walker can tell with the naked eye whether it's 95 or 89. I am convinced of that. But can he tell if Trent Thornton is experimenting with a different grip? Is this ball spinning more or is it not? Of course he can't tell. It's spinning thousands of times per second. So, or thousands of times per minute anyway, and many, many, many times per second. So you are not going to be able to perceive that with the naked eye. And of course, that's where technology comes in. And as a pitcher is experimenting with a different grip or trying out a different pitch even, that's where this stuff can be so, so valuable.
So thanks to Pete. Always appreciate his time and candor. If you want to hear Ben and I just kind of recap what's going on with the Toronto Blue Jays right now, get that on YouTube. We did a little bonus chat just about some of the excitement and follies of the Toronto Blue Jays of recent days. Ben's on Twitter at @BNicholsonSmith. Our producer is Amal Delich. Get him on Twitter at @AmanDelich. Thanks to Drew Livingstone, as always, for helping us out with the cameras. My name's Arden Zwilling. Talk to you next time on At the Letters.